If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Top Democrats have reportedly been pushing the White House to have President Biden speak to the press more often, and so are top Republicans.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with Lin-Manuel Miranda. But first, a closer look.
The committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has subpoenaed another round of Trump allies as multiple investigations of Trump and his inner circle intensify and Republicans continue their attempt to take control of our elections. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Guys, tomorrow is a big day. No, it's not just Thanksgiving. It's the deadline MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell set for himself to file his supposedly blockbuster Supreme Court case proving definitively that there was fraud in the 2020 election.
I cannot wait to drop this Supreme Court case the Tuesday at 9 a.m. before Thanksgiving, and the whole world's going to be watching all this unfold over Thanksgiving.
You are saying that on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, which I think is 4 weeks away, you're going to drop a lawsuit so you can go back and have fistfights, the family squabbles. Lindell, you're a genius. Well, you could have thought of this.
Steve, the country's going to go back.
Your holidays are ruined again, okay?
And when I say before Thanksgiving, we are bringing the case to them before Thanksgiving, everybody, getting all these states on board. We've got right now upwards of 9. I want to get at least 25 on board.
Upwards of 9 already sounds like a problematically vague wording for a Supreme Court case. And how many states are on board, Mr. Lindell? Upwards of 9! So 10? There's about 10 for sure. That ballpark, yeah. Why won't you tell us the exact number? It's not important. Just please make my friend president again. And I'm sorry, Steve Bannon thinks Americans need a lawsuit from Mike Lindell to have a reason to fight at Thanksgiving. My Uncle Ron needs 2 drinks and he turns into Mike Lindell. One minute he's telling Aunt Debbie she's his light, and the next minute he's screaming, "You pretend to be a loyal wife, but I know about the affairs!" And again, I know Lindell's from Minnesota and not Chicago, but I don't care. Still, good news for families trying to avoid conflict. Lindell has failed to file his lawsuit as promised, and he's blaming it on the Republican National Committee. Lindell accused the RNC of calling state attorneys general and pressuring them not to sign the complaint. He also said he was flying to 5 different states to get attorneys general to sign the document. Holiday travel is stressful enough as it is. Imagine being in a boarding area with this guy who is definitely going to stand up when group one is called, no matter what group he's sitting in. Plus, you know he carries his ticket in some weird Ziploc travel pouch he forgot how to open. It's tricky because you gotta pull it while you squeeze it. There are 2 things happening on parallel tracks right now in American politics. On the one hand, Republicans like Lindell are still spreading the big lie that the election was stolen and making it easier to overturn future results they don't like. And on the other hand, several Major investigations of key Trump allies who tried to steal the last election are getting more serious. For example, the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has subpoenaed five more Trump allies, including disgraced right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, who always looks like he's trying to Hulk out, even though he wasn't exposed to gamma rays, and Roger Stone, the guy who famously showed up to Trump's inauguration looking like an 18th-century oil baron who makes his own meth at home. Quick aside, we've used that photo so many times over the years, I honestly can't remember which jokes we've made about it and which ones we haven't. Here's a bunch anyway. This guy looks like Willy Wonka's mortician. Is Quentin Tarantino remaking Lincoln? He looks like a fella who just made his first million in the Zeppelin business. Dude looks like he's trying to sneak into the Met Gala to sell cocaine. Hey, Chalamet!
Chalamet! Care to partake of the devil's dandruff?
Now, you might remember that Stone was already convicted as part of the Russia investigation, but his sentence was commuted by Trump, and he ended up right back in the middle of Trump's inner circle, helping hatch their next scheme.
Stone was convicted of seven felony counts stemming from the Russia investigation, including obstruction of the investigation, lying to investigators, and witness tampering. That then only resulted in President Trump commuting his sentence in July 2020, just in time for Stone to help plan the January 6th insurrection. Stone appeared at multiple Stop the Steal events in the days leading up to the attack.
Stone is part of this constellation of far-right media personalities. Perhaps more than anybody else, Roger Stone is fluent in Trump, and he knows how to produce slogans and commentary that fit into his vernacular.
What does it mean to be fluent in Trump? You only use words with one syllable? You talk like a cab driver from Queens? Or you know how to stretch a single sentence into a rambling, hour-long monologue? Can you imagine one of those French to English travel dictionaries, except it was Trump to English? All right. Let me translate. So Trump said, a man came out to me, tears in his eyes. He said, sir, you're bringing America back, sir. We're living in the golden age of America, sir, just like the golden age of television. Lucille Ball, I love Lucy. You love Lucy. We all love Lucy, don't we, folks? She ate all that chocolate and got paid for it. What a deal. I said to my team, we need more chocolate-eating jobs, and that's what we did. We opened more chocolate factories under my administration than any previous administration in history. Witch hunt. Okay. And that translates to, I am sad inside. So investigators are closing in on more Trump allies. The investigation has already subpoenaed former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick, a close ally of Rudy Giuliani, who was part of a so-called command center set up by Trump cronies like Steve Bannon ahead of the January 6th insurrection, where they hatched plans to steal the election from Biden.
The headquarters for some key figures in Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election. Rudy Giuliani, Steve Bannon, former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick, and conservative lawyer John Eastman hold up in Washington's Willard Hotel, walking distance from the White House, in a suite of rooms they called the Command Center.
It's just fun to imagine Rudy Giuliani running a command center in a hotel room. Let's get started. Bernie, you split up the free toiletries. I call the tiny shampoo. Steve, order me a Cobb salad, but six rows of eggs. They know how to do it. It's also important to remember, these people only hang out with each other because there is no one else who will hang out with them. If Bernie Carrick had other options, do you think he would still roll with Rudy Giuliani, who publicly implied a few months ago that they all partied with disgraced royal Prince Andrew?
I told this to the Queen of England. She said, you did a wonderful job on September 11th. And therefore, I'm making you an honorary knight, commander of the royal something or other. I turned down a knighthood because if you took a knighthood, you had to lose your citizenship. I know Prince Andrew is very questionable now. I never went out with him. Ever. Never. Never had a drink with him. Never was with a woman or a young girl with him. Ever, ever, ever. One time, I met him in my office, and one time when we had the party. Right, Bernie? You were there. You weren't there? Oh.
You were there? Oh, now I remember. Bernie, you said, if anyone ever asked, I wasn't here. And then you said, wink, wink. Also, say what you will about my impressions, but they're way better than Rudy's. I mean, is that what he thinks the Queen sounds like? Who does he think played her in The Crown? Al Pacino?
Oh, nothing makes me smile like a corgi running across a well-manicured lawn. Low to the ground and fast like a rocket ship. Let's get a round of crumpets out here. It is always crumpet o'clock at Buckingham Palace.
And of course, Rudy's already facing his own criminal investigation for trying to cheat in the 2020 election before the results came in. Investigators are focusing on his attempts to dig up dirt on Joe Biden in Ukraine. And as you might recall, his home and office were raided by the feds earlier this year. Last night, he was on Newsmax and claimed that only Trump cronies are targeted by the feds.
I have to get your reaction to the breaking news. These five new subpoenas from the quote-unquote January 6th committee of Nancy Pelosi. The idea that we've had Roger Stone subpoenaed, Alex Jones, three other individuals. Add to that Mark Meadows and Steve Bannon. Are we seeing the collapse of the rule of law at the highest levels in the United States, Mr. Mayor?
Oh, yeah, Sebastian, we watched that all through the Trump presidency. I mean, the Democrats handled themselves like fascists. There were no constitutional rules. Why is it that the only lawyers whose law offices get broken into are Donald Trump's lawyer? Remember, they went and got my iCloud account. I'm a lawyer.
All right, but not really. I mean, your law license was suspended and you lost every case you brought after the election. The only thing you succeeded at doing was drumming up publicity for a landscaping company. I mean, looks like he's shooting a local commercial for them. Come on down to Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Our prices are so crazy, you'll be screaming, "Why, God? Why?" But hey, at least he's not the kind of guy who puts his thumb on the front-facing camera. More importantly, let's go back to this penetrating question.
Why is it that the only lawyers whose law offices get broken into are Donald Trump's lawyer?
Why is it such a mystery? It's like asking why the only rats who go viral are pizza rats. What about all the other everyday working class rats? When is their time in the sun? The command center, the lawsuits, the Ukrainian scheme, all of it was part of the Trump team's attempt to cheat in or steal the election. And as part of that effort, they produced memo after memo laying out a detailed plan for Vice President Mike Pence to reject the Electoral College count. There were a bunch of memos from several Trump lackeys. In fact, former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn even tried to get the Pentagon involved in their attempted coup. It wasn't just an impulse or Trump randomly lashing out. They had a detailed plan and a command center to pull it off. And believe me, I'm as shocked as you are that these misshapen potato chips had a plan. It's much easier to think of them as a bunch of easily distracted doofuses who get caught trying to steal a pen from a bank without realizing it's chained to the desk. But they did have a plan, and they came close to pulling it off, which means they're almost certainly going to try it again, except this time they're trying to do it by changing the laws to make it easier. And they have Republican officials in states across the country helping them. They've already started passing new voting laws in at least 17 states, and now they've landed on their next target, Wisconsin.
In a stunning new piece of reporting in the New York Times, Ron Johnson and other Republicans in Wisconsin have now launched an all-out assault on their state's election system to ensure Republicans have full control over its voting process. From that reporting, quote, "The Republican effort, broader and more forceful than that in any other state, where allies of former President Donald J. Trump are trying to overhaul elections, takes direct aim at the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission." Last month, a report ordered by Republican state legislators and performed by Wisconsin's nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau found, big surprise here, no widespread fraud in the 2020 election. But the report did make dozens of recommendations for the Election Commission, and Republicans pounced.
Think about how insane that is. They conducted an audit that found no evidence of fraud, but made a bunch of recommendations anyway. It's like if you went to the doctor for a physical and he said, "All right, everything looks perfect. We'll take the leg off on Monday." Not sure how many bones there are in there, but it's got to be
upwards of 9.
Callback. This is the single greatest existential threat to our democracy right now, and it's hanging over every aspect of our politics. One party wants to take control so they can never lose power again. From Steve Bannon to Roger Stone and Rudy Giuliani, it seems like everyone around Trump was involved in the attempted coup, and now that they're all getting subpoenaed, they're saying,
"Oh,
this has been a closer look."
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Our guest tonight is an Emmy, Grammy, and Tony Award-winning composer, playwright, and the creator of hit Broadway shows Hamilton and In the Heights. His feature directorial debut, Tick, Tick, Boom, is now on Netflix. And you can hear his new music in Disney's Encanto, which is in theaters everywhere tomorrow. Please welcome back to the show our friend Lin-Manuel Miranda. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
A lot has happened.
A lot has happened. Yo, thank you. You're so kind. Thank you.
So, one thing I want to ask about, you know, doing a Disney film like this, a lot of pressure in so far as how are kids going to like it, right? You were saying backstage that you did Moana. That was the first movie your oldest ever saw.
Yes, I found out I got the job on Moana. I interviewed for it, and I found out I got the job the same day we found out we were going to be parents. So it's all mixed up. Like, Moana is weirdly my oldest son's sibling.
I would imagine when he saw Moana and liked it, that's great, but he also hadn't seen anything else, right?
Yeah, he had nothing to compare it
so
to.
So he might have just been like, look, I just like the idea of movies.
yes, this concept of images on a screen is...
So now he's a little older. I'm assuming between this and Encanto, he's seen some other movies.
He has serious sophistication.
Yeah, he might have some standards now. So were you more stressful when you showed him this one?
100%. Well, you have to understand also, I wrote this during the pandemic, so they had to hear every phase of Encanto as I was writing the songs, as Daddy is talking to himself in the corner, singing, welcome to the family, magical. But I also have I have a three-year-old and a seven-year-old. They are the greatest beta testers in the world. There were moments in early drafts that were too scary for them. My three-year-old has the immortal quote. At one point, he grabs me and goes, Daddy, can we watch a kid's movie? And I went back to the director. I was like, okay, that scene's too scary. We gotta go back to the drawing board. It was great.
Stephanie Beatrice.
The great Stephanie Beatrice.
Stephanie Beatrice is a voice nurse.
Is Mirabelle is our Disney hero.
And so I know we were both huge fans of Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yes.
And it must have been so great to work with her. This I know you worked with her on In the Heights as well, but...
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the great cosmic jokes is that Stephanie became famous on a show where her voice is two octaves down and in a monotone.
Yes.
And Detective Rosa Diaz, when you actually meet her, she's like, hi! and she has, like, one of the bubbliest, most musical voices you'll ever hear. So I knew that Stephanie. I met Stephanie in our early 20s, mid-20s, when she was doing Kiara's plays, like, very experimental, off Broadway plays. So it's been a joy to... It was amazing when she had her sort of nationwide prominence on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and then... You know, to work with her on this, like, where I'm writing Disney songs and she's the Disney, like, hero. Like, I'm like, she's in a club with, like, Jodie Benson and Anika Noni Rose and Leah Salonga and all these, like, Disney heroines. So it was, we would text each other while we were recording her songs. Like, can you believe this? Can you believe this? It was great.
So you must, at this point, it must be... cool to have, like, a good working relationship with something as iconic as Disney, which, like, introduces so many children to musical theater, I feel.
Yeah, 100%. I think a lot about Howard Ashman, who was Alan Menken's great lyricist and partner, and really, I think, is responsible for ushering in that, like, second golden age of Disney. He wrote the lyrics for Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, and really just sort of brought musical theater into animation. It was like, this is how it works, guys. I was really inspired by that. And so when I started working on Encanto, I just said, I want to be there from the beginning so that the songs and the scenes can kind of go as seamlessly into each other as possible. And, you know, it's been, I'm really proud of Encanto and the work we did together.
And I'm sure when you work on a musical on a Broadway stage, you see it at every level. There's no moment where you're, you know, blown away by what happened between the night before and you know, the morning after. Right. With animation, it must be so thrilling the first time you see, like, a song you wrote.
Yeah. This is the movie I've seen the least that I have worked on. Also, because I think because we were working from home, Disney security was even more intense. So I would be like, can I just get minutes 45 to 48? Because I have to write a song for that. Can I see it, please? But it was also... What's so thrilling about writing for animation is that they can move at the speed of thought. So there's a song in the movie called Surface Pressure where, you know, this character is singing about how she feels nervous and what's under the surface. So, like, again, like, cut to my kids worried about me and me in the corner being like, nervous, surface, how big the iceberg is, Cerberus. And just as many nervous rhymes as I can get, and I write the song, and then when it comes back, the animation goes there. It can show you Cerberus, it can show you how big the iceberg is, and it can move at the speed of thought, which is just thrilling when you're a lyricist.
That's really exciting. I'm very excited to talk to you about your directorial debut. We're going to be right back with more from Lin-Manuel Miranda. We're back with Lin-Manuel Miranda, and congratulations on Tick, Tick, Boom. It's receiving fantastic reviews. So this is based on the writer of Rent, but this is not about this part of his career, or that part of his career, I should say. This was about something earlier. This was about a failure.
Yeah, Jonathan Larson was an aspiring composer. I can't relate at all. and he spent his 20s trying to... First of all, he tried to do an adaptation of 1984. Couldn't get the rights. He said, I'll write my own dystopia. He spent his 20s writing this musical called Superbia. And everyone basically said, it's really interesting. You're very talented. What else do you have? And he said, I spent my 20s writing this. And I think he processed that loss and the fact that no one wanted to produce it by writing this one-man show called Tick, Tick, Boom. And he performed it as a rock monologue with a band all over the village and all over New York. And he basically was like, it was him processing, spending his 20s on something nobody wanted to see. And as a result, it's a brilliant sort of portrait of this great artist as a young man and figuring out whether he wants to proceed in this line of work or not. And Rent is still way down on the horizon.
And you were how old when you first see this?
So I was 17 when I saw Rent. I saw the original cast for my 17th birthday from the back row of the Nederlander Theater. And that was the show that made me want to write musicals. It was the first really contemporary musical I ever saw. And then after Larson's passing, it was commissioned to be turned into an off-Broadway show. They basically turned into a three-person off-Broadway show, and I saw that. Now I'm a senior theater major. I'm like, I'm a theater major. It's just after September 11th. Like, what do I have to offer the world? And I went and saw this brilliant musical directed by Scott Schwartz, starring Raul Esparza, and it was basically this sneak preview of my 20s. It was this brilliant kind of wrestling with what are we meant to be doing with our time? And it was even more specific and brilliant to me than my experience seeing Rent at 17. And so it's been sitting in me like ever since. I was thrilled to get to direct the film adaptation.
You get to direct it and you get to take this core story, but obviously because it's film, in some degrees you get to make it bigger. And one way that you seem to make it grander and sort of a tribute to Jonathan is all these Broadway cameos.
Yeah.
And it sort of goes back to what you're saying about the speed of thought, right? Like you get to internalize this person, and it must have been so cool to reach out to the Broadway community and explain why it's important to do a cameo in this film.
Sure, and half of the folks that people are considering cameos, they're not cameos to me. They're just like great New York actors that I want to be. You know from this. You've got Richard Kind in every third thing.
Absolutely.
Richard Kind is in our movie,
too. You can't say no to Richard Kind.
You can't say no to Richard Kind.
And he will call you.
Yes. But you know, it's I just wanted great New York actors to be in this great New York story. But there are elements to it that, you know, Jonathan never got to see his success. You know, he passed away the night before Rent's first public performance. And the goal at every stage was, what would Jonathan Larson do? And what would Jonathan Larson want to see? And the film is an opportunity to go to New York in 1990, that sort of post Koch, pre-Giuliani, weirdo time in New York that I remember as a child, and populate it with Jonathan's heroes. I mean, that was sort of the goal at every step of the way.
One cameo that I think people were very excited to see is your father.
Sure.
Yeah.
When you talk about New York royalty.
Yeah.
Luis Miranda,
when
Jr.
you get Luis, I'm like, is that the Luis?
They booked Luis.
No, but how is your dad to work with as when you're the director?
I could have made it easier on myself, because the scene he's in is this uninterrupted, it's like my only Scorsese take. It's this like long dance sequence in a New York lobby, and I also wanted it to play like they're moving in slow motion. So all the dancers are dancing at 1.75 speed. So my dad has a really specific cue, and it goes by really fast. It's like, hello to Dimas Adore, man, who looks like Captain Kangaroo, and then wave! And daddy, wave! And he's got like this really tough kind of musicals. And he'd be like, I got it, leave me alone. You can't direct your parents.
No.
You know, I know Martin Scorsese put his mom in like a lot of his movies. I don't know how he did it, because I was just hearing, like, around after take five, my dad was like, how many more? Because I have a real job.
Also, Stephen Sondheim was a very important person in Jonathan's life.
Yes.
And Bradley Whitford plays him. I imagine that's something you don't take on lightly, to play Stephen Sondheim.
You made it very difficult for me, because in the great Co-op the Musical, I don't know if you've seen Co-op the Musical,
documentary
produced by
now,
Mr.
very
Seth
popular
Myers, show. Dozens of fans in the
dozens
audience.
Dozens of fans.
John Mulaney plays Sondheim.
Mulaney did a very good Sondheim.
He did a brilliant Sondheim.
Yeah.
So, you know, luckily we were in a different age bracket of Sondheim, so we cast Bradley as Sondheim.
And Sondheim liked it, right? He liked the performance.
Yes, he wrote me, "You treated me gently and royally, for which I am grateful." But he had a note, which is there's a moment in which the character of Sondheim leaves a message for Jonathan Larson, and I forget what the sentence was, but he was like, I would never say that. Can I rewrite my voicemail message?
So he thought the way you presented him in the film, even though it was him being kind, was maybe a little cliche.
Yeah, this one moment, this one sentence.
Yeah.
It was like, I think you have a bright future in this business. And he was like, I would never say bright future in this business. And so he said, can you rewrite it? And if you can't get the actor back to record the voicemail, I'll record myself. And I was like, I can't get him. I'm sorry, would you please? So we have like a rewrite from Sondheim in our movie, and it's his voice on the voicemail to Jonathan Larson.
Now that's
this cosmic reaching.
Now that's a pretty good cameo. Yeah, as you know, with all respect to Luis.
Yeah, that's how you do Allegro.
That's how you do it. Hey, thank you so much for being here. Congrats
thank
on both films, you guys. That's Lin-Manuel Miranda. Tick, Tick, Boom, available on Netflix and Encanto theaters everywhere tomorrow.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.